Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Thursday, November 11th, 2021. I'm Linda Lundgren, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. Birthdays and announcements come at the top of the hour. We'll continue with news for another 30 minutes and then change readers. Our second shift will start with the opinion pages. Obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. later tonight, followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Excuse me. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you would like to learn more about how you can help us keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. Well, now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. So it's breezy today with clouds breaking for some sun. The rain ending near Des Moines in the morning, and I think maybe that's happened. Winds west, southwest, 10 to 20 miles per hour. Patchy clouds tonight and windy late. So the high today is projected to be 51, the low 32. Tomorrow on Friday it'll be a high of 38 and a low of 26. So that is a little bit of a downward trend. Looking at our headlines today, our feature story is about Veterans Day, and it features a woman veteran, No Woman Fights Alone. Then we have an article about RAGBRAI co-founder John Karas, who died recently at the age of 91. And our ever-loving report on COVID-19, the state reaches 500,000 cases. So I will turn it over now to my partner, Barb DeHeck, to read our first story.
Thank you, Linda. And on this Veterans Day, honoring all who served, No Woman Fights Alone. Alyssa Flood's friend was cleaning out a closet when she found the fatigues. She tucked her uniform away in the bottom of the wardrobe, pushed toward the back when she got out of the Army. Left it there to gather dust. As she laid the camouflage out on her bed, a pack of cigarettes peeked out from the left arm pocket. "Are the cigarettes still good?" Flood asked her middle school friend, Lori, over Facebook Messenger. "I don't know, but I'm going to try them," Lori replied, sassy as always. "It's crazy," Lori messaged a bit later, "but I can't shake the feeling that a part of me has been with that pack of cigarettes, with that uniform, since the last time I took it off. Maybe it's a part I'll never get back." Lori's transition from active duty to civilian life has been rough, and recently the tone of her social media posts changed, becoming a little sadder and a bit bleaker, like the bad days had started to outnumber the good. The shift in the funny, quirky girl who'd been Flood's locker mate in Ankeny nearly two decades earlier was subtle, not pronounced enough to cause alarm. But a few months later, Lori lost the battle raging inside her mind and her soul. She was dead. Gone, Flood preferred to say. A victim of self-medication, loved ones still unsure if her actions were intentional or accidental. As Flood cycled through the usual questions in the wake of unexpected death, what did I miss? Had I reached out enough? Did she know how much I cared for her? She wondered how many other female veterans had trouble transitioning out of the military, trouble finding a new purpose out of their old uniform. Lori's story wasn't unique, Flood knew that. But just how many other Loris were out there? Armed with strong Wi-Fi and an even stronger conviction, Flood, 33, hunkered down on her Colfax couch, opened Facebook, and created a page. Bombshell Patriots, she wrote, would be a group dedicated to ensuring every female veteran has a place to turn when life on the home front gets to be too much. She added a Rosie the Riveter and typed out a tagline, No Woman Fights Alone. When she went to bed that night, the group had 6 followers, all personal acquaintances. By morning, more than 300 women had joined. And 2 years later, the nonprofit organization has continued to explode, spreading mostly by word of mouth. Today, Bombshell's Facebook page boasts followers from 48 states and 13 countries. A planned January website redesign will feature new forums and easier access to resources, a shiny Bombshell verse, Roy says. And in September, the digital group made its biggest offline move yet by hosting the first State of Iowa Female Veterans Conference. The event was so well received that it will expand to 3 full days next year. Since starting the group, Flood has cultivated an image of power and of femininity, shedding the stuffy, staid nature of some military-sponsored organization, she says, flipping her hair to reveal her head shaved on one side. She wants to appeal to my generation, whether that be through TikTok videos or group texts, memes, or Instagram-ready promos, motorcycle rides, or martini-soaked mani-pedes. Come to Bombshell as you are, all battle scars welcome, Flood says. But understand, out of her deep grief came an even deeper purpose, to keep as many veterans as she can on the side of the grave. My job now is to do whatever I can to make sure your family and your friends don't stand where we stand to visit Lori, she says. Sitting in the shadow of an illuminated American flag wood carving, a hobby of her veteran husband, stories rush through Flood's mind of all the women who, before contacting Bombshells, had reached the end of themselves. There was the 20-something, so busted up from service that pain shots through her spine. Leaving her hobbled and down. She came to the page seeking a community, a way to connect, even when she was homebound. There was the mother stuck in an abusive relationship. She needed gas money to get her daughter and her truck across state lines. There was the woman stressed to her limit over a contentious custody battle in which her PTSD diagnosis had become central. She just wanted a Bombshell to look over her paperwork for fresh eyes to assure her she hadn't made any mistakes. And there was Emily Meyer, 25, a Waterloo native, whose goals had been centered on climbing the military chain of command before a serious ankle injury drummed her out of the service. She meant to be a lifer, but she made it only 4 years. Quote, one day, they say you can't serve anymore, and you want to throw up and cry and scream and yell, all the same time, she said. Then you get out, and you feel like you don't belong anywhere. Family doesn't get you. Your whole life has changed. The requests Bombshell receives run the gamut from help for suicidal thoughts or treatment for a long-ignored sexual assault to asks with much lower stakes, like how to wear your hair not in a bun or how to socialize with men who aren't fellow soldiers. Whether big or small, when women get out of the armed forces, there's almost a deconditioning process, Flood says. Everything starts with, what do you need, Flood says. Literally, what do you need? And we will go from there. Most, like Meyer, come to Bombshells searching for a place to fit in, for a new identity, not one covered in camo. Officially, Bombshells' mission is 3-pronged. The group is a bridge connecting women in crisis with available services. It's a digital, and sometimes in person, space for camaraderie, empowerment, and guidance. Recent posts from active duty soldiers include what to do when your period starts while you're in the field, and advice on the finer points of covertly dressing and undressing in a sleeping bag. And lastly, it's an in-your-face statement that women that have long served in the armed forces and long will. The lack of recognition, whether that be by people asking a woman wearing a battlefield hat where her husband fought, or denying a female veteran a posted discount because it's only there for those who served, is one of the most common issues Flood hears. A paralegal by trade, Flood isn't a veteran. A bad case of asthma kept her out of uniform. However, the military, the virtues of service, and helping your fellow woman run deep in her family. Her grandpa was a Marine, her dad too. Her family was stationed at Camp Lejeune when she was born, but moved back to Iowa soon after. A jughead through and through, Flood's dad never stopped wearing a high top, she said with a laugh. He taught his children military cadences and call and response songs made for marching, which Flood and her siblings, a four-member troop, loved repeating, parading up and down the supermarket aisles. Birdie, birdie in the sky, dropped a little whitewash in my eye. I'm no sailor, I won't cry. Thank the Lord the cows don't fly. But Flood finds herself connecting with female veterans for more than just family lineage and a lost friend. Flood fought anxiety and depression and battled back from abuse and the deep-seated belief that she would never, could never, amount to anything. That voice inside her head telling her she wasn't good enough gnawed at her so viciously that she tried to take her own life as a teenager. Brokenness recognizes brokenness, she says, even if the circumstances differ, and if a member isn't strong enough. Right then, to show her dragons, an army of bombshells is steady behind her, ready to pick up their swords and go to war. No woman fights alone, ever. This is a family, more than a community, Meyer says. Everyone looks out for one another, whether you're 10 minutes away or hours and hours and miles and miles. We genuinely care about each other and genuinely want to help one another. Back at middle school, when they'd chat in the dugout of their softball games or at their lockers during passing periods, Flood noticed Lori was the sort of girl who picked up everyone around her. She was always the one to ask, "Hey, you doing okay?" Since her death, Flood's wondered if anyone had ever really been that person for Lori, and if having that person would have made a difference in the end. Sometimes her mind wanders back to Lori's funeral, to the emptiness she felt then. Other times it drifts to an impossible future, one where Lori is part of the group physically, not just spiritually. As the group grows, Flood believes she's living her God-given purpose. But she's also had to confront her own demons, namely the nagging voice inside her head telling her she's not good enough, that she's not cut out to lead, that she's not truly one of them. Breathe, a veteran friend once told her, and remember, you're not speaking for yourself, you're speaking for all of the veterans who aren't ready to speak for themselves yet. I've never been able to be strong and brave when it came to me, Flood says. But I'll mess you up over somebody that I care about. So don't mess with my girls. They are my girls, and I'm going to take care of them. Nearly all of Flood's off time nowadays is filled with bombshell work. Flood organized the group as a non-profit, funded through sponsorships and merchandise sales. It's about as grassroots as it gets right now, but Flood's slowly building her coalition. Next year, she'll seek grants and donations with more fervor, in the hopes of eventually building a headquarters complete with classrooms for resume assistance and studio space for restorative yoga. Flood's journey founding and nurturing Bombshell Patriots may have started with a casualty, but defining the group by loss alone is selling the story short. Scars, you see, don't have to simply be a reminder of what's happened. They can just as easily be a memorial to what's happened next. Bombshells will ultimately be defined by gain, Flood says. For her, the gain is nascent friendships and newfound purpose. For members, the gain may be an answering or a helping hand, or in finally discovering the strength to pick up all the sharp, broken pieces of their lives, in the fortitude to lacquer their ragged edges back together. Or maybe the gain is just knowing that there's an army of bombshells at your back, each one ready to pick up swords and slay dragons. Back to you, Linda.
Well, I'll read the story about John Karas. RAGBRAI co-founder John Karas dies at 91. Register rider colleague hatched bike ride idea. John Karas, a former Des Moines Register features writer and co-founder of RAGBRAI, the annual bicycle event that sees 15,000 people ride across Iowa, died on Wednesday, surrounded by loved ones. Karas suffered a hard fall and a minor stroke in recent months and died from complications of that trauma, a family friend confirmed. He was 91. Way before Karas and fellow Register columnist Donald Call nurtured the idea for RAGBRAI, the pair were just a couple of middle-aged cycling enthusiasts with a love of rural landscapes. You drive around Iowa, and it's not very impressive in a car, Karas previously told the Register. And one of the things that Don and I found bicycling, when you bicycle through Iowa, it was stunning. incredible. In 1973, the Friends got a wild hare to ride across the state from the Missouri River in the west all the way to the Mississippi River in the east, and write about the towns they stopped in and the people they ran across. Shoehorning the adventure into, quote, work was a great way to have the register pay their expenses, Karis often joked. Inviting readers along on their inaugural journey was their editor's idea, and Karis thought the notion was stupid to boot. When he saw the turnout of nearly 100 cyclists at the starting line, he was even more nervous about the whole endeavor. "I was just thinking, where do we house these people?" Karis said. Almost 50 years since that first group hit the road, RAGBRAI, an acronym for the Register's Annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, is now the oldest, largest, and longest recreational bicycle touring event in the world. Rolling annually from west to east, the ride has become a cultural behemoth, beckoning people from as far away as Saudi Arabia to the cornfields and main streets of small-town Iowa. "I've met some pretty amazing people in my life, and John Karis ranks at the top of the list," said Dieter Drake, RAGBRAI's ride director. "He has been and will continue to be an inspiration to me and to generations of RAGBRAI fans, past, present, and future. We are forever in his debt." Karis, born in Cleveland, and Call, a Detroit native, were known as some of the newsroom's big city guys. Despite that urbane upbringing, the week-long ride invented by these two ink-stained friends has come to define the Hawkeye State, said Carl Voss, a former Register photographer and cycling community mainstay. "If you introduce yourself and say, 'I live in Iowa,'" Voss said, "the response is, 'Oh yeah, I had a friend who rode on that bike ride.' It's become an identifying positive aspect of Iowa that many people know. But being synonymous with Iowa is just one spoke in the wheel of how Karis and Call's idea has impacted the state. The explosion of bike trails throughout Iowa happened in part because of the spotlight RAGBRAI brought to cycling," said Tim Lane, another veteran rider and a close friend of the Karis family. "And as RAGBRAI riders pedaled over gravel roads in sweltering heat, they spent money and time in small rural communities. There's simply no telling how many churches have roofs or high school teams have uniforms because of funds raised by hungry cyclists. Past the borders of Iowa, RAGBRAI has made a huge mark on cycling," Lane added. "Back when Karis and Call tightened their chains, biking was hardly the heralded pillar of modern life that it has since become. But due to the success of RAGBRAI, other states created rides spanning large distances, and biking transitioned from a hippie pastime to a legitimate mode of exercise and transportation. John and Don had a larger impact on cycling than Lance Armstrong," Lane said. "In the newsroom, Karis was a strong presence," said Chuck Offenberger, a former Register columnist and RAGBRAI co-host. "After long nights on the Register copy desk, Karis would notice fellow editors slowing down, worn out from hours of fixing typos and tenses. Sensing they all needed a break, he'd yell, 'Okay, everybody, animal sounds,'" Offenberger said. "It was a signal for them to get up off their chairs, run or jump around, imitating monkeys, cows, bulls, birds, elephants, whatever. When not editing, Terrace penned feature profiles, concert reviews, on Deadline, and yes, many RAGBRAI dispatches. The itch to write never left the longtime newspaper man, who anchored a column even after he'd retired and moved to Colorado. A reader suggests I quit writing about bicycling, Karras wrote in 1982. I've tried. God knows I've tried. But some dark, irresistible impulse drives me to it again and again. Even as Karras and Call, who died of cancer in 2018, sometimes pushed back against the celebrity that came along with being the RAGBRAI founders, they loved the ride deeply. 1 year after the last day's tire dip in the Mississippi, Offenberger found Karras riding his bicycle in circles in the hotel parking lot, wanting just a few more pedals before they went home. It came to mean so much to him that when it ended each summer, he was going to miss it, Offenberger said. He was a genuine celebrity out there. Then the next week, he's back on the register copy desk. In recent years, Karras's room at Scottish Rite in Des Moines was peppered with RAGBRAI paraphernalia, and a road-ready bike still graced a back corner. Long after Karras had put down his pen and hung up his helmet, he made a point to come out to the RAGBRAI route for handshakes, autographs, and selfies. He'd wear a bike jersey as riders sidled up to him to tell stories and share memories with Grandpa RAGBRAI. When driving himself became impossible, a legion of caretakers helped him make the trip, often setting up under a tent near the finish of the Karras Loop, an extra portion of the ride that lets riders get in a full century 100 miles in 1 day. Despite the exponential growth of RAGBRAI, those who've been a part of this two-wheeled circus for years say its spirit remains true to the newspaperman's vision from all the way back in 1973. A week of cordial, informal, happy insanity, as Karras once wrote. What do we do if we're out there on the road between nowhere and nowhere and it starts to rain? We'll probably get wet, Karras wrote. And when the rain stops, if we haven't found shelter on a farmhouse porch or in a barn, we'll dry out. How many miles do we ride before stopping for meals and water? As many as we wish. In riding 60 or 70 miles a day, how long will it take? Just as long as it takes, not a moment longer.
And in our final front page story, state reaches 500,000 COVID-19 cases, 1 in 6 Iowans infected during the pandemic. More than 500,000 Iowans have contracted COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, according to data released Wednesday by the Iowa Department of Public Health. The 967 new cases reported this week brought the state's total to 500,119 individual Iowans who have tested positive for the disease since it first reached the state last year. That means the coronavirus has infected about 1 in 6 Iowans at some point in the past 2 years. Iowa's number of cases is again on the rise, with the state reporting an increase in new confirmed cases for the third week in a row. This week's average of 1,295 new reported cases per day was up 19% over the previous week. While cases are climbing, the state has an additional tool to curb the virus after federal regulators approved a COVID-19 vaccine for children as young as 5. COVID-19 hospitalizations, which had declined each of the previous 4 weeks, also increased, according to Wednesday's data. There were 524 Iowans hospitalized with COVID-19, including 113 in intensive care and 52 on ventilators. More than 70% of the patients hospitalized with COVID-19 were not fully vaccinated against the disease, including 85% of those in the ICU. The share of the state's population that is fully vaccinated against COVID-19 increased just 0.2 of a percentage point in Wednesday's update, a slight decline from previous weeks. About 53% of the state's population is fully vaccinated, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Additional data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that nearly 1/5 of those fully vaccinated Iowans have now received a booster dose, the extra shot now available to some at-risk populations. The state also reported 97 additional COVID-19 deaths this week, some dating back to mid-September. COVID-19 has now caused or contributed to the deaths of 7,166 Iowans. As has been the case for the last several months, children made up just under a quarter of the new COVID-19 cases reported this week, or about 2,000. 8 were hospitalized with the disease as of Wednesday's update. Last week, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became available for children ages 5 to 11. Wednesday's data update did not yet show the number of doses that have been administered to children in that age group so far. However, about 7,000 Iowa children were able to start their vaccination process by the end of the weekend, according to Ken Sharp, Iowa Department of Public Health Administrator, helping coordinate the vaccination campaign. On Wednesday, he called that good news and promised the number of doses administered would rise. Biden administration officials have promised he would have its pediatric vaccination distribution program fully running this week, after the Pfizer vaccine was approved for young children last week. In Iowa, the doses started being administered in many locations on Thursday, albeit with limited shots available. Many pharmacies that provide the adult vaccine were still getting their programs up and running through the weekend. There are some, I think, frustrations we're hearing that parents weren't able to get their vaccine where they would normally go to get the vaccine, and I think it's just a matter of timing, Sharp told the State Board of Health at its regular meeting Wednesday. We're still taking that as positive news of parents, that parents are excited about getting their kids vaccinated and looking for that vaccine. There are about 284,000 children ages 5 to 11 in Iowa, and the state received about 99,000 doses from the federal government, not including those shipped directly to pharmacies. Sharp said all 99 counties should have pediatric doses available by this week. The state also ordered another 24,000 doses. CDC assumptions on vaccine take rates show about 30% of parents would want their children vaccinated immediately, Sharp said, which covers about 95,000 newly eligible children. Another 20% to 30% would likely wait a little bit or until it's more convenient, such as during other scheduled vaccinations. The remaining are hesitant, Sharp said. CDC has assured us that there will be not any supply chain issues for the pediatric vaccine, and right now we feel like things are going as smoothly as they could be given the rollout of that new product, he told the board. Meanwhile, the board member, Dr. Donald McFarlane, with University of Iowa Healthcare, asked for a stronger pushback on anti-vaccine rhetoric. McFarland said he was concerned about how vaccine opponents are misusing the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Effect Reporting System, known as VAERS, that's V-A-E-R-S. The data, he said, is made up of unverified, self-reported events that aren't necessarily associated with any vaccine. Sharp said the state receives regular updates from the CDC about VAERS reports, and there have been 0 Iowans who have died because they received the COVID-19 vaccine. Sharp told McFarland that the state health department would discuss how to better communicate that message. I think there's a very different message for the general public to understand what those data elements are and to understand that literally anyone can report into VAERS on a perceived correlation between a negative impact or adverse effect from a vaccine, Sharp said. And the latest COVID-19 numbers in Iowa? The latest data as of 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 10th, compared with the previous Wednesday. Confirmed cases? 500,119, an increase of 9,067. Deaths? 7,166, an increase of 97. Total tested, 2,141,764. Total recovered, 465,549. and a statewide 14-day positivity rate, 8.9%. How many Iowans are hospitalized with COVID-19? Hospitalizations, 524, up from 483 one week ago. Patients in ICU, 113, up from 111. And patients on ventilators, 52, down from 53. How many people in Polk and Dallas counties are vaccinated? In Polk County, 288,796, or 59% of residents, are fully vaccinated, an increase of 1,330, or 0.3 percentage points, since last week. In Dallas County, 54,760, or 59% of residents, are fully vaccinated, an increase of 272, or 0.3 percentage points. The five counties in Iowa with the highest percentage of their population fully vaccinated as of November 10th are Johnson, 63%, Buena Vista, 61%, Linn, 59%, Polk, also 59%, and Dallas, 59%. For a county-by-county look at the vaccination rollout, you can see the COVID-19 vaccination tracker, which is updated weekly.
Well, turning to the metro section, Miller Meeks to run in District 1. The U.S. Representative had to choose between first and third. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks will run in Iowa's first congressional district, avoiding what likely would have become a competitive and expensive race against fellow incumbent Democratic U.S. Representative Cindy Axney. Miller Meeks, a Republican, had to make a choice whether to run for Congress in the newly redrawn 1st District or in the 3rd District, which was redrawn to include her home in Ottumwa. Ottumwa is in Wapello County. She announced her decision at a news conference at Dahl Old Car Home in Davenport on Wednesday morning. The newly drawn 1st Congressional District encompasses the bulk of the 2nd Congressional District that I currently represent, and it includes more than 80% of the constituents that I currently serve, Miller Meeks said. She said that, while Wapello County is not part of the new 1st District, the counties included in that district have been home to her. Miller Meeks said that in light of the disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, coupled with the change brought on by redistricting, her constituents deserve stability with an incumbent representative. I can offer that stability by running and representing the people I currently represent, she said. The decision follows the state's redistricting process, which shifted the boundaries of Miller Meeks' old district. I never wanted people in this district to feel like I was betraying them, she said. People in Wapello County and Iowa know that I will take them with me, and I will advocate for them, and I will be their voice, regardless of the district I represent. Miller Meeks did not say if she will move into the new district, saying she plans to make a decision about where to live at a later date. Members of Congress are required to live in the state they represent, though they are not required to live in the district they represent. Ultimately, where I reside is not as important as announcing a decision about where I will run, so that other candidates and potential candidates can make their decisions, she said. Other people were waiting for me to announce my decisions so that they could move forward. I can decide later where I live. Democrats Christina Bohannon of Iowa City and Joseph Kerner of Knoxville have announced campaigns in the 1st District, and a primary election is scheduled for June 7th. Bohannon, a state representative, reported raising $305,100 during the quarter that ended in October. She had $243,617 in cash on hand. Kerner, who has been far less prominent, reported raising $3,272 with $3,072 in cash on hand. I welcome Representative Miller Meeks to the race in Iowa's new 1st Congressional District. While she's been weighing her political prospects and voting against bipartisan infrastructure improvements for Iowa, I've been traveling throughout Iowa's 1st Congressional District, meeting voters where they're at, Bohannon said in a statement. Bohannon said she's been honored to hear from people about the issues that matter to them, including fixing roads and bridges, creating good-paying jobs, supporting small business, and improving education and health care. One thing is clear. Southeastern Iowans want a congressional representative who values truth, integrity, and will put delivering results for the people of Iowa above divisive partisan politics, she said. Miller Meeks, who has served 1 year of her first two-year term, reported raising $418,693, giving her nearly $1.5 million in cash on hand. She announced her intent to run for re-election at an event in September on the outskirts of Iowa City. According to reporting from the Quad Cities Times, Kyle Kuhl, a businessman, veteran, and political novice from Bettendorf, announced earlier this week he would also run as a Republican in the 1st District. The new 1st District covers southeastern Iowa, reaching from Jasper County in the north to Lee County in the south, with a western panhandle stretching into Warren and Marion counties in central Iowa. Though different geographically, the new southeastern district largely resembles the previous one in terms of voter registration. Democrats previously made up about 35% of voters there, and they become about 34% of the new district. Republicans stay at about 32%. The southeastern district includes 15 of the 24 counties Miller Meeks previously represented, while 10 of them now sit in the 3rd district, which includes Ottumwa. But even with her familiarity in parts of the new 1st district, Democrats see an opening. In 2020, Miller Meeks narrowly defeated Democratic challenger Rita Hart, winning the seat by just 6 votes. But Democrats carried the set of counties that now comprise the 1st district by a little more than 2,000 votes. Going back to 2018, the Democratic congressional candidates had an even larger 36,000 vote advantage against the Republican candidates in the counties that make up the new 1st District. That year, former Democratic U.S. Representative Dave Lubsack represented the southeastern Iowa seat, and Axne unseated former Republican Representative Dave Young to win her first term. The goal is to win by more than 6 votes, Miller Meeks said. Miller Meeks said running against Axne didn't factor into her decision. She said she thinks her voting record and her work as a congresswoman will help her win favor when reaching out to her new constituents. I will do that the same way anybody would when they're embarking on a campaign, and that is going to their central committee meetings, reach out to businesses, reach out to individuals, reach out to farm groups, if they're more rural, she said. She said she will evaluate where to have her district offices, but will continue to have one in Davenport. Miller Meeks said if she wins a new term in Congress, she wants to focus on veterans issues, immigration, job creation in southern Iowa, and standing against COVID-19 vaccine mandates. A reporter asked Miller Meeks to defend her vote against the $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan that recently passed Congress. She said she was on the fence until it was time to vote, but to her, it came down to how, in her view, President Joe Biden linked that bill with the separate reconciliation package that is still being debated in Congress. According to a news release from Axne's office, the infrastructure bill gives $5 billion in investments to Iowa, the bulk of which goes toward repairing highways, airports, and bridges, improving water infrastructure, expanding broadband, and improving public transportation. Miller Meeks said Biden's policies are causing increased inflation, gas prices, and a crisis at the southern border of the United States, which she said are harming economic growth. She said she will also vote against the reconciliation bill if it comes before the U.S. House. Miller Meeks' decision has other ripple effects across Iowa's political landscape. Retired State Representative Mary Ann Hanusa, a Council Bluffs resident, previously announced she would run in Iowa's 3rd congressional district. But as a result of redistricting, her home county of Pottawatomie now sits in the 4th district, which is more heavily conservative and represented by incumbent Republican U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra. Hanusa said Wednesday she had been waiting on Miller Meeks' decision before deciding what to do with her own campaign. "I was not going to challenge her, obviously, if she decided to run in the 3rd, Hanusa said. "But now that she's not, I will look at my options. A lot of the counties that remain in the 3rd, in the new 3rd, are counties that I have campaigned in, that I have support in. So I'm going to look at the situation, and I'll make a decision shortly."
Chappelle's faces Des Moines crowd. Dave Chappelle's Des Moines screening of his new documentary was not as star-studded as his first two shows on an 11-city national tour, but that didn't dampen the crowd's standing ovation as the Grammy-winning comedian took the stage Tuesday. "A lot of people wonder why I'm coming to Des Moines," said Chappelle, after launching into a stand-up act for the 5,600 attendees at Wells Fargo Arena. "I'll tell you the truth, it's because you pick presidents, and you do a terrible job." Over the course of at least 30 minutes, the comedian continued to joke on topics like getting an order of protection, time travel, his marriage, and the reception of recent Netflix comedy special, The Closer, which drew backlash for what critics said were his transphobic comments. "Boy, I went too far with The Closer," Chappelle said. "The trans always get mad, but this time I did it." He went on to express a feeling of whiplash between being on Twitter and meeting individuals in person, saying that few, if any, of the LGBTQ people he's spoken with face-to-face have expressed outrage he's experienced on the social media platform. "Be kind to everyone," he advised his audience. "When you see one of these rare transgender unicorns, buy them a coffee and tell them Dave Chappelle sent you." He also recounted being in Des Moines the day after Kobe Bryant died, when he endorsed then-Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang in the 2020 Iowa caucuses. He appeared with Yang on stage at a show in Ames. "I've never been here and not had fun, but no matter what your governor says, coronavirus is real," Chappelle told the Des Moines crowd, taking a jab at Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Audience members at his show were required to show proof of vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test within the previous 72 hours. Chappelle's appearance in the lengthy show followed performances by DJ Trauma, Roastmaster General Jeff Ross, and the comedian Earthquake, leading up to the screening of Chappelle's 2.5-hour documentary titled Untitled. Indiana-based rapper Freddie Gibbs was the main musical act. Chappelle himself sang, as he called it, karaoke style, on stage, and invited audiences to sing along with him. He even invited one of his own bodyguards to show off a surprisingly strong singing voice. In general, the quantity of performers seemed diminished compared to reports of Chappelle's previous two stops in San Francisco and Minneapolis. At Minneapolis Target Arena, Chappelle was joined by pop stars Justin Bieber and Usher. And while in California, he tagged R&B artist Gopal and soul singer-songwriter Rafael Sadiq, among others. Across the performances so far, Chappelle and Ross have seemingly been the only constants among the documentary itself. Untitled depicts Chappelle's experiences during the 2020 COVID-19 lockdown as he began doing live performances in a cornfield near his hometown of Yellow Springs, Idaho. Pardon me, Yellow Springs, Ohio. I sound like an Easterner. The documentary, which debuted to critical acclaim at New York's Tribeca Film Festival in June, includes appearances by a slew of comedians who contributed to his shows, including Chris Rock, Jon Stewart, and Tiffany Haddish. When I was on stage in Ohio, it was literally just me freestyling and talking about what's going on in the world. Joe Coy, one of the comedians who performed at Chappelle's event, said in a late 2020 interview as he was preparing to tour again, expressing genuine relief about being able to perform live during the pandemic. If anyone knows laughs, it's comedians. And you always know if the audience is laughing because it's the end of the joke or if it's because they're feeling it. When the film by Academy Award-winning documentarians Steve Rogner and Julie Reichardt, Chappelle's Yellow Springs Neighbors, was shown in the first stop of his current tour at San Francisco's Chase Center on November 4th, it reportedly drew approximately 19,000 people. Chappelle's Minneapolis show reportedly also drew a far larger audience than for his Des Moines appearance, which filled less than a third of the 17,000-seat Wells Fargo. When Chappelle appeared in Des Moines at 1,252-seat Hoyt Sherman Place in 2016, his first show sold out in less than 10 minutes, and he added a second. And Allison Fegley, Hoyt Sherman's director of bookings and event services, told the Register the line for tickets was the longest she'd seen in her 8 years there. In that appearance, and Chappelle's 2020 show on Ames, Tuesday's show was a no-cell-phone affair, with attendees required to place their mobile devices in locked pouches for the duration. Shortly before the show, Wells Fargo management also informed a Des Moines Register journalist that Chappelle representatives also had banned notebooks. Among those in attendance was Corey Woodbury of Iowa City, who said it was the first time he'd made the drive from Iowa City to see the performer. He said it was worth it. "It was amazing," Woodbury said. "I love the documentary. It's much needed for the world. We need a good laugh, for sure."
Before reading the next article, there is a picture on the front page of the Metro section of community leaders, officials, and employees of the Central Iowa Shelter and Services. They're cutting ribbon on a new 24-unit, low-income apartment complex. The Central Iowa Shelter is on the southwest corner of the downtown area. Former longtime State Human Services Director Charles Palmer dies at age 82. Charles Chuck Palmer, who was director of Iowa's Department of Human Services for 16 years, died Sunday. He was 82 and lived in Des Moines. The job Palmer held is one of the highest profile positions in state government, because it involves the care and protection of hundreds of thousands of Iowa's most vulnerable residents. Palmer first served in the position from 1989 to 1999 under then-Governor Terry Branstad. Branstad left the governorship in 1999 and then returned in 2011. He quickly asked Palmer to resume running the state's largest agency. Palmer, who was then in his early 70s, didn't hesitate to step back into the pressure cooker role, Branstad said in an interview this week. "That is really far and above the call of duty," the former governor said. He really loved human services and serving people. Palmer understood his job would draw critics, and he responded to them calmly, Branstad said. "He always was accessible to people and was thoughtful and caring," Branstad said. Mark Anderson, who served as chair of the Department of Human Services Advisory Committee, said the department tends to draw little attention for its contributions, such as when its staff helps protect thousands of children from abuse. The spotlight hits when something goes tragically wrong, he said. On your best day, nobody notices you. On your worst day, everybody does, said Alec Anderson, who is a Lutheran minister in Waverly. Before becoming the department's director, Palmer spent a decade leading the agency's division of mental health and developmental disabilities. He previously worked as a social worker, following in the professional footsteps of his mother, Elizabeth Palmer. He never forgot those experiences, Anderson said. His heart was really that of a social worker, Anderson said. He really cared about the clients. In his second stint as Human Services Director, Palmer oversaw the reorganization of Iowa's mental health services from a county-by-county hodgepodge into a statewide system coordinated by 14 regional authorities. He also led the 2016 transition to having private companies administer Iowa's giant Medicaid healthcare program. And he oversaw the 2015 closure of state mental hospitals at Clarinda and Mount Pleasant, with their services transferred to the state's other two mental hospitals or to private agencies. Those decisions drew anger from critics who said they would weaken care. But Palmer contended the moves would make services more efficient and effective. The soft-spoken director often stood up at public meetings to hear the concerns and explain his views. He retired in 2017, and investigations into the deaths of two teens who'd been adopted out of foster care. His departure came shortly after Kim Reynolds succeeded Branstad as governor. I just felt it was important that the new administration bring their own people together to put together their agenda, he said at the time. Kelly Garcia, Iowa's current Human Services Director, praised Palmer Tuesday during a meeting of the agency's advisory board. He was very active up until his last days, she said. He was a friend and a confidant, and just an incredible advocate for those who serve in our system. An obituary posted by Hamilton's funeral home said a memorial gathering will be held in 2022. Survivors include his wife, Karen Palmer, daughter, Diane Palmer, son, Mike Palmer, and two grandchildren. Memorial contributions may be made to the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Woman sentenced in fatal child neglect case. A Des Moines woman was sentenced to prison Tuesday after pleading guilty to felony neglect of a dependent person. Denver Emery, 21, wasn't originally charged with child endangerment causing death in 2018. The Des Moines Register previously reported that prosecutors alleged she and her boyfriend, Nicholas Rivera, caused the death of 2-year-old Calvin Trillinger, Emery's brother, who sustained brain bleeding and bruising as a result of abusive head trauma. Emery and Rivera were his sole caregivers, and the injuries were found to be non-accidental, police said. Emery filed an offered guilty plea earlier this year, meaning she asserts her innocence but admits prosecutors' evidence would likely convince a judge or a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. According to court records, Polk County District Court Judge Scott Beatty accepted the plea and sentenced Emery to a maximum of 10 years in prison, with credit for time served. Emery must submit a DNA sample, pay $1,370 in fines, an undetermined amount of damages, and $150,000 in restitution. Rivera, 40, pleaded guilty in May and received a similar sentence in July.
Well, here's some good news. Ready or not, Des Moines could get season's first snowfall Friday. A cold front that moved into the Midwest on Wednesday brought the recent unseasonably warm temperatures down to normal levels, with a high in the mid-50s, and some light rain. Thursday, we'll see a high of around 50, according to the National Weather Service, before more precipitation starts and temperatures drop further. By Friday, some parts of northern Iowa could have an inch of snow. In Des Moines, there's a 30% chance of rain and snow before 4 p.m. Friday, according to the National Weather Service, which says Iowa's capital has a 39% chance of getting at least 0.1 inch of snow. If it does snow, Des Moines shouldn't get more than an inch. So the forecast, I guess we've read weather before, but it is in this article. Thursday, sunny during the day with a high near 50 and a low around 33 with gusty winds from the west. Friday, windy with a high temperature of 37 and a low of 29. A 30% chance of rain and snow before 4 p.m. And Saturday, mostly cloudy with a high near 39 degrees and a low of 31. A 20% chance of rain and snow before 7 p.m. Esterville has a 42% chance of getting at least 1 inch of snow Friday, according to the National Weather Service, and Sheldon has a 37% chance. Visibility could be reduced because of snow and strong wind, with gusts as high as 45 miles per hour in some parts of the state. The wind chill in northwest Iowa will be in the mid-teens Friday morning, while other parts of the state should feel in the 20s. Is it unusual to get snow this late? Not at all. Last year, the city's first measurable snowfall came on October 18th, when 1.8 inches fell. The next day, 9 inches fell in parts of the metro area when a snow squall hit. But storms like that are outliers. Des Moines' earliest occurrence of a trace of snow happened on September 26, 1942, and the city's latest first trace came on December 6, 1948. Des Moines got its earliest inch of snow on October 18, 1991, but in the winter of 1943-1944, Des Moines had to wait all the way until February 10, 1944, to get its first inch of snow.
Iowa joins third lawsuit against vaccine orders. Iowa and 9 other states have filed another lawsuit against federal COVID-19 vaccine requirements. The state joined a lawsuit Wednesday challenging a Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services requirement that all health care workers at facilities that receive federal Medicare or Medicaid funds to be fully vaccinated by January 4th. Quote, medical providers that have been on the front lines of this pandemic, saving lives, deserve the freedom and ability to make their own informed health care decisions, Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, said Wednesday in a statement announcing the lawsuit. Iowa has 5 state-run health care facilities that use Medicare and Medicaid funding. Iowa joined the states of Alaska, Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming in the suit. This is the third lawsuit Iowa has joined to oppose the Biden administration's series of COVID-19 vaccine mandates. On October 29th, Iowa joined 9 other states in opposing a vaccine requirement for employees of federal contractors. Separately, the state has joined a lawsuit over a vaccination requirement for businesses with 100 or more employees. A panel on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has temporarily blocked the mandate for large businesses, which is also set to take effect January 4th. Reynolds said Tuesday she hopes the rule continues to be blocked while the legal challenges proceed. Iowa Democrats have responded to the various lawsuits by criticizing Reynolds' pandemic priorities. I believe state leaders like Governor Reynolds should be focused on getting people to use the vaccine, which is proven by science to be effective, rather than playing political games with lawsuits and things like that against the Biden administration, House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist, Democrat of Windsor Heights, told reporters Wednesday. Confrist encouraged parents to have their children vaccinated as soon as possible. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention approved the Pfizer vaccine for kids 5 to 11 on November 2nd, making more than 280,000 Iowa children eligible for the shots. Reynolds, who is vaccinated and has previously encouraged Iowans to take the vaccine, said Tuesday that parents of children between 5 and 11 years old should talk to their pediatricians about it, but she stopped short of recommending the vaccine outright.